Welcome to Fun Problems, the problems of fun, the only podcast that updates every week reliably without ever missing an episode and no gaps whatsoever. We actually just won the Guinness World Record for most reliable podcast updates over the longest amount of time. So congratulations to us. Thank you to our lovely audience. I'm Peter C. Hayward.
I'm AJ Branded.
And this is our first episode in, I think, 19 years.
Yeah, well, we had technically two episodes recorded like a year ago and then they just didn't go up, so
will they go up, AJ? Will they see the light of day? I guess by the time people are hearing this, they will have already gone up.
Yeah,
there were more technical difficulties, but we are on the way away from technical difficulties, we believe.
It's not the first time we've said that.
I said on the way, I didn't say out. I just said, you know, on the way, starting to progress.
I'm just not good at editing, okay? Let's admit this. I'm not good at editing.
The editing is fine. It's the recording process. Right. We keep running into trouble. What are we talking about today, AJ?
Today we're talking about foundational games, which is something you're very excited about and are going to define for our audience.
Yes. So today I wanted to talk about an idea, which is something that we've kind of discussed. We sort of had two different definitions for it, so we're just going to kind of muddle through, which is this idea of foundational games. You know, the classic saying of like, if you're a writer, you need to read. If you're an artist, you need to go look at art. Like, you can't create in a medium without also absorbing in that medium. And yes, you could just go to the local pub that has games and sit there and play whatever they have with whoever they want. But if you're really serious about being a game designer, which is what this podcast is geared towards, people who are serious about being game designers, I think that there is a huge amount of value in finding specific foundational games and going to play them just to like understand the genre or build tools for your toolkit. So it is a bit of a broad definition, but there's basically, I've just made a list of games, and I think you also made a list, question mark?
Yes.
So we basically just made some lists of games that we're going to talk through and just be like, here's why this is worth playing. And just to be clear, this is not like, play it because you'll have fun. Like, hopefully, you know, classic games you will have a good time with. But if you are, again, serious about being a game designer, I'm not saying it's a miserable thing, but I will go and play co-op games. I don't like co-op games. I'll go and play games that it's not for me, but I can learn tools from it and I can kind of see either where the industry is going or where the industry's come from. And tools is the main thing. Just building tools for a toolkit.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to note that what we're talking about here is a bunch of specific games that we think have different lessons or are relevant if you're designing in that specific genre. But if you're designing any game, you should definitely research a lot in that specific genre. I just started working on a new card game. First thing I did was I researched every single CCG, TCG I could find so I could learn the lessons that other people have already spent time learning for me.
Yeah. I sort of think of these as homework games in a sense. My list, I'm gonna list the game and then say what I think you can learn from it. Because the other thing that these games do is they demonstrate what is possible in the cardboard space.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it.
Okay, any further ado, my friend?
A little bit. I just want to spice things up a little bit.
Okay.
I have three in particular that I think stand very far head and shoulders above the rest of the ones on my list.
Okay.
I wonder if there's any on your list that really strongly stand out as like, every single designer here, I do not care, you have to play this game. Because I assume not every designer is going to play every single game we're about to mention. We're about to mention a lot of games.
No, of course not.
So these are the three for me that's like, please just go play these ones. If nothing else, you have to.
I should also warn you, I went really specific on mine. Okay. Mine aren't like, here is worker placement. Mine are like, what's an example? Above the table, creative dynamics. And then another category is above the table, interpersonal dynamics. That's what I mean. Like, these are hyper specific. So, okay, I'm gonna go ahead and just guess one that I'm pretty sure is on your list and you already know is on my list, mm-hmm. which is Twilight Imperium.
Twilight Imperium is not one of my top three, but that is definitely on my list. So let's pause guessing. Let's talk about TI. Good segue.
Okay, so Twilight Imperium, I have the game that I have in brackets, like what the thing is. And for me, ARC. A-R-C, ARC. If you want to understand the capacity of ARC in a board game, I have two games under ARC. One is Twilight Imperium. Can you guess the other one?
Oh, that's so interesting. I'm going to edit hopefully. This long pause.
Hopefully this is interesting, otherwise it's just us playing a very random guessing game.
Innovation.
I don't think you've played this one.
Okay.
No, that's an interesting call. Mage Knight is the other one.
Oh yeah, I haven't played that one.
Yeah. So Twilight Imperium and Mage Knight for me are the two exemplifiers, the two foundational games, the two homework games of what you can do at the start of the game is radically different to what you are doing at the end of the game without the rules necessarily having changed. Now, Twilight Imperium cheats a little bit in that, yes, you literally change the rules as the game goes on with the voting system, but in terms of, like, you learn the game and then you play the game and what happens at the end is so different to what happens at the start. I made this list literally like a year ago now, 8 months or whatever it was, and I'm wishing that I had some shorter games like Innovation or probably some Sea games would fall really nicely under this. But just, yeah, any game where you... Well, okay, so let's talk about Twilight Imperium. So Twilight Imperium, I think, excels at Ark, A, because of the sheer length of it. A full, like, six-player game of Twilight Imperium is probably going to set you about 8 hours. And in order to justify those 8 hours, there has to be Ark. Yep. If it was like Azul, where you're kind of doing the same thing over and over, like, I love Azul. I think Azul's amazing. Azul would not last for 8 hours.
There's a reason why in basically every AAA video game that are like 20 to 30 hours, they aren't one gameplay system. It's almost a meme. There's stealth, there's crafting, there's collectibles, there's cutscenes with story, there's action. There's set piece moments. And why are there all those different types of things? To give you breaks from them. Because if you were just doing the action, it doesn't matter how good the action is. You can't just do pure action 8 hours without it getting boring.
Yeah. You can't even do an action for 8 hours without getting boring, to twist your words slightly. So Twilight Imperium has multiple types of arc. One of which is obviously if you've played it. If you haven't, go play Twilight Imperium. Even if you're not going to enjoy it, like, I was trying to say, like, if you're like, I don't like games that go for more than an hour, cool, you will still learn so much from this, and it'll be worth it, even if you're not, like, giddy with joy the entire time. I think, again, if you're serious about it, I think this is the kind of thing that you gotta do. So Twilight Imperium, let's talk about the tech tree. That's a really obvious form of arc. As the game goes on, you unlock new technology. The technology lets you do different and better things. And now you have more options than you did earlier, or the options that you have are more powerful. That's just a really clean example of how art can be integrated into a game.
Mm-hmm. There's also like the rules of the game changing, like you said, with the politics, where everyone votes A or B. If the majority of people vote A is now a rule of the game. That is now part of the game system. There's also like things that you unlock in the expansion. There's all sorts of like alliances that add to the arc. Like, if someone betrays you 4 hours into TI, that does a lot to change up what the game is going to look like for the second half.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. TI, I think, really perfectly balances what I call above the table and on the table. Is this something we've discussed on the podcast before?
Worth repeating. It's been years. No one even remembers what we said before.
I'm Peter, by the way. I make games. Hi. Thanks for listening for the first time of the year. So above the table is literally, I mean, it's a very intuitive term. Above the table is me interacting with you, AJ. On the table is me interacting with the game's mechanics. And Twilight Imperium has arcs. One of the reasons I think it's such a foundational game for arcs is that it has every type of arc you can have. It has, like I said, the tech tree. There's a spatial element where you're exploring out the map. There's new things that you can do. There's new laws and rules coming to the game. And then, as you said, there's shifting alliances. And most games of TI are not won by playing the game on the table. They're won by playing the game above the table, or both in conjunction. Like you said, if someone betrays you 4 hours in, cool. Do I care about winning as much as I care about getting you back? Probably I should, but the nature of the game is like, well, you messed with my trust and you're going to pay the consequences. We could talk about Twilight Imperium for a whole 2 hours. So anything else on TI before we move on?
Nope, let's get going.
Mage Knight, I'll briefly mention because it does something very differently in terms of arc to TI, which is at the start of the game, you are very, very weak and it is grueling to do anything. On my turn, I want to move 2 spaces and buy a thing from the item. I will spend there for 5 minutes trying to work out how to make the cards in my hand let me do that. By the end of the game, same rules, you know, you've upgraded your cards, it's a deck builder, you've upgraded your abilities, it's an RPG in that sense. By the end of the game, with still 5 cards in my hand, I am leaping 4 spaces, killing a dragon, turning around, going another 6 spaces, defeating a city, like, not literally on both turns, you can't do those on both turns, don't at me, but with the same amount of like available cards, you are doing literally 10 times as much. And this is over the course of a 2 to 3 hour game. You feel that progression so extremely from your first turn to your last turn. I think that game does Ark better than almost anything else I've ever played.
But okay, so I already brought up innovation in relation to Ark. How would you say that does for Ark?
Ark innovation is such an interesting game. Innovation absolutely explodes. Like, you're suddenly doing all kinds of crazy stuff. So I definitely think it has an arc. It has an arc in a different way to the other two, which is why I'm struggling to align them.
Just for audience members who aren't super familiar with it, you've got basically a tableau building game where you're going to be playing out cards. They have tags that you can use for different effects, so the more of a certain tag you have, the better the effect can be. And you've got a couple simple actions that manipulate where cards are in different zones. It's very abstract, but has a pasted-on theme of civilizations from the Stone Ages to literally using nuclear weapons. And the scale of the game...
And beyond. The last age is set in the future from where we are.
Right. And it scales that way, too, where it's like, if I'm in, you know, medieval times, I've got all these, like, stone fortresses and those types of technologies that I'm using, and then my opponent could invent gunpowder and use that. And immediately, I'm completely invalidated. It's like, your entire tableau is blown up and it's turned into points for me. And you think, how am I ever supposed to come back from this? And then two eras later, you're like, oh, that was nothing. I don't even care about that anymore.
I think the difference for me, and this is also a really good example of, I would call that a foundational game because it does something different with Ark. Twilight Imperium, it's about the dynamic changing as the game goes on. Mage Knight, it's about the combinations kind of upgrading, and like you tend to buy combinations that upgrade with the other stuff. Innovation, it's less about comboing and more just like the cards themselves get crazy because there's decks 1 through 10. And the cards in deck 10 are about 10 times as powerful as the cards in deck 1. So as soon as you get a card from the next deck, you are just, you know, doubling or tripling in power.
Gotcha.
What were your big ones that you thought I would definitely have or definitely think of?
If you don't have Pandemic on there, then you're a crazy person.
I don't, but again, I wasn't doing it by genre. Like, I don't have a cooperative genre.
Sure. So I split my list into two. I've got genres where it's like, if you're working in the genre, I think you just got to check it out. And I think I've got ones that are just lessons that I want designers to learn. So if I think a game did a particularly good job teaching a lesson or using something that really special way, then I've marked them down.
Mine's much more about demonstrating specific aspects of games.
Yeah, I'm
glad. Which is why I like Pandemic's not on there.
Yeah,
for sure. Great. Okay, Pandemic, hit me.
So Pandemic is almost too good of a co-op game, I think, in that there's a mechanic in Magic the Gathering called Kicker, where you can pay an extra cost when you play a card and you get an extra effect. And as either the best mechanic in Magic or one of the worst, because it has so much utility that it shuts down design space for every other mechanic, because almost every other spell-based mechanic that you make is just Kicker. And
yeah, I think of code names like that. It's really hard to make any kind of game that's similar to code names without it becoming code names. Or Dixit's another example,
Which are both on my list.
Yes.
But yeah, with Pandemic, I think it just does such a good job in so many ways of building the quintessential structure of an against the game co-op. It has, you know, bad thing happens at the end of each player's turn, so it automatically scales for the number of players. It has seeded bad events in the deck so that the really bad things come up at the right intervals without it being too mathed out and too consistent.
Yeah. Regular without being scripted or unpredictable.
Yes. I think it was either Jeff Engelstein or I think it was Gil Hova who was talking about the cadence of variance spikes, where you want to have a small number of like big spikes and a lot of like little ones. So you have a lot of little disruptions to the plans that you have, but then every now and then there's a big one where you're like, oh, I have to deal with this. And Pandemic is that whole concept embodied perfectly.
Right.
And yeah, if I was making an against the game co-op game, it would be very hard for me to do anything other than just follow the model that Pandemic did, because it did it so well that it's just polarizing me towards it. So unless I'm doing something really, really different that can't possibly look like Pandemic, I wouldn't even try, because I would just be cloning it.
at that weight, I assume you mean. Because like Spirit Island, Settlers of the Multiverse, like they are also pure against the game co-ops, just at a wildly different weight, and so they go in a completely different direction.
Yeah. Like, obviously, it's not like every single co-op game is Pandemic. Sky Team is a two-player co-op with like dice placement. Like, those aren't comparable games, but if we're talking about like the weight of Pandemic trying to be a pure against the game co-op, the structure, the cadence of everything, it's just nailed it.
Yep. It's all there.
Yeah. My next one is one of the biggest games of last century.
Monopoly.
No, that is on my list. So why do I think Monopoly deserves to be played? I think there's an arc that every designer goes on, I think. When they first start thinking about game design, even as a player, even if you're not a game designer, where you're like, you know what? Monopoly's a bad game. This kind of isn't fun to like randomly roll every turn and land on things I don't care about and then spend hours and hours losing money. And then eventually, you know, you're like, oh yeah, I feel like I'm a really smart designer. I get that Monopoly's bad for all these reasons. But there's a lot of reasons to like Monopoly. And I don't want to spend all day on Monopoly's strengths, but there are strengths in Monopoly. People like collecting sets. There's an inherent fun in set collection. It's like the square peg into the square hole type of a thing. People get to trade in the game. There's like an excitement to the game. It's fun to feel rich when you got like tons and tons of money in front of you. There's a lot of fun stuff that exists in Monopoly. There's a reason why it's the most popular game in spite of the flaws that, yes, I would agree with. And I think that as designers, it's easy to focus on the low-hanging fruit of what's wrong with Monopoly without appreciating the things that does well. And I'll also point out that Catan has a ton of overlap with Monopoly. In fact, I think it was maybe even you that pointed this out to me in the first place. But you roll two d6s at the start of your turn to see what your resources are. You can trade things with other players. You're set collecting. You're gathering together resources. There's even like random action cards and stuff like that. There's a lot of similarities, and there's probably a lot of similarities for a very good reason. Those are things that people enjoyed about Monopoly in spite of the things that they didn't enjoy about Monopoly.
So I'm a big Monopoly defender. I don't think you can find a single better game from 1910 than Monopoly. It would only make my Foundationals game list for one reason. It's not a reason that you mentioned. And that is, it is a game that everyone knows. And so if you can borrow from Monopoly, then you are greasing the way for people to understand your game. And that's my specific theory on why Catan works. I think Catan works because you sit someone down to play a Euro and they're like, "Well, it's too much. I don't understand." Whereas if it's like you sit them down and you say, "Hey, you roll 2d6 at the start of your turn." They're like, I know that. Obviously, I know that. Everyone knows that you roll two dice at the start of your turn because that's how Monopoly works. And if you're told like you can trade, they're like, "Yeah, of course. I know how to trade. I've played Monopoly." So I would put Monopoly on my list only for that reason. I think all the other stuff you mentioned, you can find other games that will exemplify that better. And even the specific thing of overlooking the flaws to find the gems, I think Talisman is a more foundational game for that.
Never played it.
Oh, right. You should put it on your homework list.
Yeah, you're right. Well, I have another two. Do you want to guess or shall I just start telling you?
Oh, give me the category and I can probably guess it.
You will in fact guess it. CCG.
Ah, yes. Magic. The gummoning, what's it called?
The Gathering. Are you doing a bit? I think you're doing it. It's so hard for me to tell. I even get to see a video and I still am not sure. So yes.
The gummoning.
So part of the reason I have Magic on this list is the same reason I have Monopoly on this list. I think that new designers are like, oh, Mana Screw, Mana Flood is bad. I have too many resource cards and not enough action cards. I lost because of pure luck. And I think many, many, many games that have been designed in the last two decades have been made in response to Magic the Gathering and its resource system saying, this is bad, and here's how I'm
going to fix. This game exists to fix this problem, yeah.
Right.
General piece of advice, I don't think that's a good way to start a design.
I think it's a good way to start as a beginner designer or like as practice, you know what I mean? Like to modify a thing that you almost like or you like but.
The reason I set up against it is because I've seen so many pitches that are like, this game is going to replace X because I fixed that problem. And it's like, oh, you don't understand the six, like you don't understand how anything works.
Yeah, even if you made literally, it's Magic the Gathering, but 5% better, even 10% better. It's literally Magic the Gathering, but 10% better. Nobody cares. We already have Magic the Gathering.
Yeah, we already have that established for 800 years now.
Mm-hmm. But similarly, the resource system has a bunch of positives. It gives weaker players a chance, it increases variance between games, it gives you something to adapt to between turns, reduces the cognitive load so that your information horizon isn't too big where you're planning a million turns in advance. But even all that aside, that whole comment about playing it to understand why the quote-unquote flaws in it are actually strengths, I think it's just done so many things and it's been so influential in so many aspects of the hobby, I can't even begin to list them, that it's just something that I think every designer should take a look at.
So here's, it's not on my list, but if I were to put it on my list, I would have put it under a very specific, again, all my lists just hyper-specific.
Sure.
Magic the Gathering is a different game to every player, or it has the capacity to be whatever game you want it to be. So Obvious example is there is the draft format, like you know, pick and pass drafting, I think was invented for Magic the Gathering. That's not even the primary game mode. Not that there is necessarily a primary game mode.
Well, there's the feature in itself. Yeah, like you're saying.
Right. Two-headed dragon, commander, competitive, casual, pauper. Like, I used to play Magic the Gathering as a teenager against my one friend, and we both had no money, so we were just trying to make like weird fun decks with little cards. That's the extent of my Magic the Gathering experience, and it was a very rich, fulfilling experience. I never went to a competitive scene. I never played in a draft. I never played two-headed commander. Like, I didn't do any of those things. I did this one very specific thing that most Magic the Gathering players might not have done, and yet I had a very rich, rewarding experience. So yeah, Magic for me is just the versatility of the game itself. No other game. The only one I can think of is not a tabletop game, which is Minecraft.
I was going to say Minecraft is the best example of that.
Yeah.
But see, Magic the Gathering even has advantages past that and appeals to different people in different ways than that. It's collectible. So I know some people who, they don't even play the game. They just collect the cards because they like them.
Yeah.
And people will build decks and be like, this is my unicorn deck. I just like unicorns, so this is my unicorn deck.
Yeah. It can be a creative expression thing. AJ and I have got a game with a publisher. It's not public at the time of this recording, so we don't know if we can announce it. But we've been talking about balance, and this is where the Magic the Gathering thing came up a lot, which is that like our game, we are not balancing it for tournament because there are ways to add a different mode to balance for tournament. And without Magic, I don't think we would have necessarily come to that. The game can be different for different groups, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then my last absolute must play is Fog of Love.
Oh, I haven't played that yet. It's on my unplayed list.
Well, you should add to your homework list.
I shall.
So I have Fog of Love for two reasons. It was my top in two different categories. If it was either of these categories, I would have put it up here. But it's not. It's both. So for one, the less important one, it is a DM-less role-playing game. That in and of itself is incredible. I know I've talked about it on the podcast, so I'll be brief about this. It's a two-player rom-com simulator where you are both playing people who are interested in the other, and you go through different life events trying to accomplish your personal goals that you have for the relationship. And there's a lot of tiny, awesome details in it, like character creation is you have a handful of different traits. You hand one to your partner, and they look at it, and they're like, okay, this is part of my character now. You are character creating for them. And the idea of this is it's like, this is something about you that I noticed, and it made me appreciate you, those kinds of things. There's a lot of tiny things like that, and the fact that it has like a goal system that is so well woven into the game, it just does so many cool things. So, DM-less role-playing game, I couldn't imagine it done better than this one. The other thing that I think that does, and this is the thing that made it on the top three, is it has the best in-game tutorial I have ever seen, bar none.
Oh, really?
It is so good. It is every single one of my games that could possibly have a tutorial, I am strongly considering doing it because of Fog of Love, and in the same way that Fog of Love did it. Basically, there's tutorial cards, and you pick up a card, read what it says, cool. The first one might just be like, here's the anatomy of a card, play a couple cards. So you play a couple cards.
Yeah.
And then woven into the decks are more tutorial cards. So the first time you're about to draw a new card type, first you draw the tutorial card, and it's like, hey, here's this new card type, here's how it works, play it. So then you play it, and you keep going. It so organically introduces the game to you that you don't need the rulebook. Literally, the rulebook says, don't bother reading this, just play the tutorial. It's already, like, unpack the cards and start playing.
That was the structure I wanted that time you killed me, but I was I was outvoted, and probably correctly. But when I pitched that time you killed me, it was just a deck of cards and components, and you'd flip the top card and start playing.
That's a pity.
I think it did okay.
Yeah, true. Your what, best, second best selling game?
second most profitable game. Second
most profitable. Yeah, I think the Friedman Freeze Fast Forward series does something similar to it, but
yeah.
Those are much similar.
Flea is my one that it's my only against the game co-op that I truly love and have played solo multiple times. Mm-hmm. I don't play solo games normally.
Right. But those are much simpler, so it's much easier to do that. And there's like much fewer components. It is just a deck of cards, whereas Fog of Love has more things going on. So, I no shade at all to Fast Forward series. I think they did a great job with it. I think Fog of Love does a similar thing, just better and more robustly. So there's more lessons to learn from that.
I look forward to checking it out.
Mm-hmm. You want to hit me with one of yours?
Yeah, okay, so I have a category that have different games under it. So my first one is something that I talk about obsessively because I'm so fascinated by it, which is using every part of the buffalo, which is a possibly apocryphal reference to the indigenous people of the Americas, which is that, you know, when they killed the buffalo, they used every part of it. They used the bones, they used the skin, they used the gonads, they used every single part of the buffalo. And as a concept, that's something I really enjoy in board games. So I've got five examples. Do you want to try to guess any of them? You know two of them for sure.
Did you make any of them?
No, I don't have any of my games on this list. Oh, I do. I do have one of my games on this list. I lie.
I'm trying to guess from your perspective. I know one of them is Caverna Cave versus Cave.
Oh no, actually, that's an interesting.
That should have been
cool. List, no, right? that was not on my list.
Hmm.
That does it once. I'm talking about games where in their entirety they do it. So in the same way as like you know, sure, play Cave versus Cave to see that one aspect of it. But these other games, the entire game does this. In the same way as Twilight Imperium, every part of that is Ark. In Mage Knight, every part of that is Ark.
I've got one that might not be on your list, but I think should be on there. Hive. The board is also your pieces.
Yeah. It's not quite the way I'm describing, because like Carcassonne's the same way. Like,
no, not quite. Like, you still have your meeples and stuff like that, but anyway, what are yours?
Okay, these are games that, for me, every part of them utilizes every part of the space. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
There is no stone unturned. So I'll start with the one that's not a tabletop game, which is Barbara's You. Barbara's You, I talk about endlessly, and every possible thing you can do with that game is done within that game. Like, I think you meant expansion or something like that, and there just wasn't, like, there's nothing else you could do. Like, there wasn't space. You had to, like, introduce colors or music or something like that. And so I'm talking about a game that, like, says, okay, we have these four things. What is every combination of these four things? And then they completely fill that space. That's something I love so much in game design. Barbara's You does that amazingly. But the one that I thought you might guess was Circle the Wagons. Because that is just 18 cards. It's a button chai game. And the front and back of them are used. And there is no wasted space in that game. Everything that you could do with these front and back of cards is used. It's incredible. Another 18 card. Oh, go ahead.
Sprawlopolis being the same thing, right?
Yes. Sprawlopolis is Circle the Wagons, but cooperative, so less interesting. Circle the Wagons. You lay all the cards out in a circle at the start. Circle the Wagons. And it's a draft where if I take one, you get everything before that. So if we just go card, that's fine. But if I want something that's like four cards up, I'm giving you three cards to take it. And I love that tension. I find that really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Also from Button Shy, also 18 cards, is Spaceship, the solo game that I first played at Button Shy Con last year and I've just been fascinated by ever since. Again, it's 18 cards. Every card, the front is split into three parts and the back is split into two parts, and you will use every single one of those parts as they rotate throughout the game and become all kinds of stuff. It like takes the amount of space that you have in 18 cards and wrings it dry. Like, it's amazing how much they get out of that. That's what I mean about every part of the buffalo. Mm-hmm. So Hive, well, definitely I can see where you're coming from. Like, for me, Hive would be that. Right, well, back of the tiles, or like I can think of 20 different movement things that they haven't done in Hive and won't do in Hive. Like, Hive is very constrained. These games take that constraint and go everywhere with it. The next one is one that we've already mentioned, and you'll understand immediately why it's on here, which is Innovation.
Yep.
Innovation, the cards are your scoring. They're also your, what are they called? The
tableau?
No, the In innovation, the back of the cards have numbers. Use those numbers to add up to your score. You can also claim them as achievements, and if you get a certain number of achievements, you win. They have like four different spaces where icons can go, and where those icons are matters a lot. And it's just like, with nothing but, there's no tokens in that game whatsoever. With nothing but cards, and what, 60 cards, 80 cards, something like, less than 100 cards, he does everything you can do with them. There's five colors, and there's stuff like, draw the top card of this deck, and if it's this color, do a thing. And just like, I wouldn't have, he just does everything you do when you're just using cards. He has randomization systems, he has scoring systems, he has fanning out systems, he has everything in that game. It's incredible. And then the last one is a bit of a strange one. Have you played any of the exit games?
I have played a quarter of two or three of them. I was not a fan.
So,
but they do every, use Enterprise the Buffalo.
Yeah, every exit game that I've played anyway has done a thing where I'm like, surely they must be out of ideas. And then they'll do something where I'm like, how is there... Oh, they take the fullest advantage of their medium out of any game I think I've ever seen, any tabletop game I've seen. Barbara's You would be the equivalent for video games.
I think we should give a spoiler example of that. And if you're listening, just press skip ahead 30 seconds, all right? 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. You've hit the skip. All right, Peter, go ahead.
So, for example, there's one where to solve the puzzle, you need to look at the barcode. Mm-hmm. I don't even think of the barcode as part of the game. Like, it physically is. It's literally there. They're using every part of the buffalo. Oh, that blew my mind. Like, actually, I'll tell a slight tangent that's very related. Do you know why we have the pop culture image we do of ninjas?
No.
So, real life ninjas, they were a thing. They did not dress all in black and look like very out of place, because that would be ridiculous. They dressed like ordinary people to blend in, like kind of like Assassin's Creed more than what we think of as a ninja. The specific imagery we have ninjas comes from Japanese plays, there's a term for them I can't think of, where the actors would be at the front doing stuff, and then dressed as, like we think of a ninja, would be the stagehands, just moving stuff around. And so the full black dress was just so that you didn't even think of them. Like, that you just tuned them out, in the same way as in the example that people have skipped ahead from. I didn't even think of that as a possibility, because I just, you know, tuned that out as a thing. Some incredibly brilliant playwright had a character disguise themselves as a stagehand. So halfway through the scene, a stagehand steps forward and rips off his mask, and it's the character. And that, it's like they sprung out of thin air. Like, people have been so trained to just block these people out that he used that, and he was an assassin, and so that's where we get the imagery of ninja. But that's the kind of thing that I mean, where, like, stuff that I would never even think of, like, oh yeah, I guess that, you know, it's just background for me. Ah, anyway. I'm in such awe of those games.
That's such a good anecdote. I absolutely live for things like that.
All right, my next one is above the table interpersonal dynamics.
This is a great category.
Thank you. Any guesses? You'll know all of them.
I hope Inhuman Conditions is on there.
It's not, but I can see why you'd expect that.
I'm a little offended. New Angeles?
No, again, you got to remember, I'm trying to find stuff that condenses this to its purest form.
Right.
That's what, for me, a foundational game is. It's like, if you want to learn this, here is this in its, like, essence form. Which, in Human Conditions, would have been a good pick for this, you're right. New Angeles has too much other stuff going on that's not above the table interpersonal dynamics.
That's fair. Oh, something like Cockroach Poker?
Something like Cockroach Poker, yeah. I could have put Cockroach Poker. I put like three equivalents instead.
What's your?
Okay, The Resistance.
Good one.
I think that one just like took the social, sort of like we were saying about Pandemic. It is hard to make a social deduction game because The Resistance is so incredible.
Okay, what's your next one?
The Mind.
Ooh.
It is that above is the table interpersonal dynamics. That's all it is.
That would be the purest, I think. That's a good one.
I don't know. So the next one I have is Skull, which is, again, I could have put Cockroach Poker here. I could have put a few different games. It's just you make a choice and then you look at other players and try to work out what they did. Mm-hmm. And this one you have the bidding to go off. But again, the bidding is like interpersonal bluffing, I believe. And the last one, I would argue, is as pure as The Mind. And I don't think you've played this one, so that might be why it didn't even occur to you. It's another button-shy game, In Vino Morte.
I have I have played this game. It has been ages. I think I played one round of it, and I was like, yeah, it's not for me. But Cockroach Poker is also not for me.
Right. The rules are dead simple. It's the wine game from Princess Bride. It's the wine scene. So one player has 8 wine cards and 8 poison cards, and they put a card down in front of every player, including themselves. They can choose whatever they like, as long as there's at least one wine and at least one poison. Mm-hmm. The player to the left goes, they can either flip their card and drink the wine, or they can swap it with any other player. You keep doing that until you get back to the first player. They don't get a chance to play or swap because they know everything is. Everyone flips the card in front of them and drinks it. If you're out, you're out. If you're in, you stay in for the next round, you go again until one player wins. So there is nothing in this game except for, do I think AJ is the kind of player who would put wine in front of me or poison in front of me? Do I think that he would swap it? It's just pure above the table interpersonal dynamics.
Yep.
This one I particularly recommend for if you have like large groups of non-gamers, they go crazy for it. Like, because everyone knows the Princess Bride. I play this game a lot because I host so many game nights with non-gamers, and this one is such a riot.
That's another really good example. I would agree. I think that is as pure as the mind.
Let's go back to you, because my next one is going to overlap with that list, and so we'll give it some breathing space.
Sure. I think because we've gone on a little bit long, I'm just going to try and go more quickly through a few of these.
I will not.
All right. We'll see how quickly we can get through. Brass Birmingham, multifaceted economy. I think...
Oh, interesting.
I think
that... Yeah, I can totally see that. Organic economy, too, almost, like...
Yes. Yeah, it's the type of thing where you look at the market and you say, the market is missing X, I want to provide that, and the X is so very different to what other people are doing and helps other people in different ways. So it's not just like, oh, there's coal and gold and wheat, and there's not much wheat in the market, so I'll just produce more wheat and sell into the market. It's, I can't move around the board to build my things. Oh, I'll build you a road. Great, now I can move around and build things. And I get rewarded for having built you a road. So I think if you're looking to do a multifaceted, like you said, organic...
I see what you're saying, yeah. This is not quite the same, but I'd put another game in that category. It's, I'll give you a hint and you can guess it immediately. It's our favorite game title. Sidereal Confluence, trading and something in the X something something. Oh, God.
Oh, Peter. It's my favorite game to. It's Sidereal Confluence, trading and negotiating in the Elysian Quadrant.
I believe you'll find it's trading and negotiation. This is just embarrassing for you. That one, in a very different way to Brass, but that also has a very, like, organic economy.
Yeah.
Because it's literally just people trading. Anyway, no, Brass, I can absolutely see that. I mean, genuinely, I think there is room for a much purer example of that, and I would love to see that. I haven't played Hegemony yet, but I've heard that does like a similarly interesting thing.
Not really. Like it, I wouldn't say it's like crazy different or anything. It is like, oh, there's this hole in the economy. More than one player is able to produce it, but because each of the factions is so regimented, it's not like anyone who wants to.
Gotcha.
You know, like I played the government. Right. I can't produce things.
It's socialism, not capitalism.
I'm going to put down Onitama for counterplay. I think counterplay...
Oh, interesting.
I think there's two ways to think of counterplay. I think that a lesson that can be learned is how fun is it to play against the opposing effect, and two, there's just thinking of it as a direct interaction point. And I think that Onitama's counterplay, for those who don't know, basically you've got 2 cards, and it's an abstract strategy, kind of like chess, but instead of having each piece having its own movement... The 2 cards you have a printed movement. You can apply that movement to any of your pieces, but then you swap it with a card that's in between you and your opponent. So you are literally handing your opponent the ability to beat you. So
it's the ability to do the move that you just did, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think in terms of that latter lesson, in terms of the interaction points and giving your opponents and players tons of interaction, tons of agency over how the game state evolves, I think Onitama is a must play.
I would add to the counterplay category all the level 99 games, the 2-player combat games. Those are like very pure counterplay games. Hmm. I can't think of the single name of them, and I haven't played them in years, but you know the games I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, they're all like 2-player card battling, super like focused things.
Yeah, and they're all about counterplay. Like that's the predominant thing that they do. Hmm. My next one is above the table, creative dynamics.
Surely, Dixit make it on there? Above the table?
Dixit's on there.
Yeah, okay.
Yep. This is the category that has one of my games, too, so you'll know that one.
Not French Toast.
Yeah.
You think?
So, what I mean here is, and I'm countering this to interpersonal dynamics, Resistance of the Mind is about looking at you and being like, what can I deduce from watching my friend AJ? Mm-hmm. These ones are about what can I produce to help my friend AJ. So I'm thinking of the guesses in French Toast more than I am the Toastmaster.
Yeah, I see it in the category. I don't know if that would make my like purest form versions of it.
I think it just does it differently to all the others. So the other ones I have on this list are Wavelength, which French Toast and Wavelength are sort of two sides of the same coin. Dixit, Code Names, which is huge for this, and Just One.
Yeah, I would have said Just One or Wavelength would have been mine. And by the way, guys, I love French Toast. This is not a slight against French Toast.
And you like the game as well.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah, and so all of these are, for me, games where the game is... You couldn't play this against a robot. Like, maybe with AI or whatever, but like... You couldn't program a computer to play this game because it's about reading the other person, not are they lying or not, or like what are they trying to indicate non-verbally, but it's about putting something out there that, and you have complete freedom. You can say any word in the world for all of these games.
I'd also add Decrypto to that, because yeah, I think Decrypto requires so much knowledge of the person, even though there's like a pretty prescriptive set of things that you're looking at. I think... threading the needle of helping your...
I've got Code Names as the equivalent. I think Code Names is more accessible.
Definitely more accessible. Definitely. But I think...
I love Decrypto, don't get me wrong.
I think Decrypto would be a pure form of it, though, just because you have to... When you're thinking about it, you have to engage not just with what your teammates are thinking, but you really have to engage with what your opponents are thinking. And, you know, you do that to an extent in Code Names, obviously.
I would agree, except that this list is for people who like are going to try a thing that they don't necessarily like, and your first five games of Decrypto are going to be garbage. I really want to find a regular Decrypto group and just get really good at it, because I keep teaching people, and then they mess up, and we play again, and they mess up, and I'm like, cool, in like three more times, we'll have a really fun time. Okay, this one I've talked about on the podcast before, so I'll say it quickly, which is, this is the game that taught me the sheer... power of making the player want to do everything all at once, giving a bunch of options and making them want to do this but they want to do this before they can do that, and just like that's the game. And I found that so compelling. It's Mosaic. I don't think you've played this one.
I have played Mosaic, the story of civilization.
Yes. And so there's like seven open drafts, and you want all of them every turn, and you've got to choose, and that is such an interesting, like, again, kind of tool for the toolbox. Like, I didn't know that my games were missing that until I played that game.
I played it with the expansion. I didn't have that experience, but I think I didn't have that experience because I played it with the expansion.
Yeah, I haven't played the expansion. I've only played the base game a few times.
Yeah, the expansion has a lot of more, like, specific things where it was like, oh, I really want boats. Well, there's nothing that gives me boats.
Yeah.
I have Black Orchestra as a design lesson on...
I think this is the second one I haven't played.
This is using quote-unquote bad mechanics in the right way. So this is, I think, just a design lesson to learn where it's like, there's no such thing as a bad mechanic. It's just, are you using it in an appropriate way to bring forward
your... Achieve what you're trying to achieve.
Exactly. You have to go sit in the corner and not see other people and not talk to other people for maybe like 15 minutes, even longer potentially. Like you are not allowed to talk to them at all. The entire game comes down...
AJ, I hate to tell you, this is just because the players you were playing with didn't like you. They're just like, sorry, AJ, the next rule is you got to go out and buy us all pizza and then leave it here and go home. It's such a crazy game.
See, that explains it, because after we played Black Orchestra, that was just a rule that kept coming up in every game that they taught.
You were like, man, this group has a real type.
And the whole game comes just down to a die roll. Like, the whole game, you are spending trying to load a die roll that's against you. And at the end of the game, it's basically just flip a coin. Oh, you lost. Except it's like, flip five coins in a row. Oh, one of them came up tails. You lost. That's basically the game. But the game thematically is about you trying to take out Hitler. That's very hard. And each of those steps is so thematically done and so well integrated that I can't fault it. Like, I was I've never been so shaken after having played a game, because I was like, I didn't like that. That was not for me. They used a lot of bad mechanics that weren't fun, but that was such a perfect experience for what they were trying to deliver.
Yeah. Tools in the toolbox. Mm-hmm. Okay, I've spoken about above the table interpersonal, I've spoken about above the table creative. This is the inverse of that, which is mechanical bluffing or goading. And this is one of my favorite games that I know you don't like, because we have exactly opposite taste in games like this. It's Schottentotten.
Yes, I hate Schottentotten. If I made a list of like top 10, maybe top 20 list favorite games, Schottentotten would be on there.
Yeah, it's in my top 10 games of all time. and the reason it's on this list is because you are just putting numbers down. That's every turn you're going to put one number down. And there is so much like, oh, is she putting that down to goad me into playing my really good card here? Or is she like, actually, I play this with my girlfriend, which is why I defaulted to she pronouns. Normally, I would never talk about women. I just want to get that on the record, make that very clear.
We just came back and now we're getting...
It is the primo example. I think you make an argument for Lost Cities as well. Lost Cities, I enjoy less in the same way as you probably enjoy it much more. But that is a game where you are playing numbers on cards, and yet it's one of the most intense experiences purely from numbers on cards and being like, do I go for it? Are they goading me? Again, since playing that, I've put that into games now. That is a tool that I took from that game and have now implemented into my own designs.
I'll give a shout out similarly to Air, Land & Sea, which is on my list as the most elegant game and a game that you should play
for
the
really?
I think so.
The most elegant game?
Yeah, I think of it a bit differently to your using every part of the buffalo. I could imagine them using...
What about Go?
I mean, I haven't played Go. I can only make a list of things that I've played. But
okay. I was going to say, Go is considered the epitome of elegance in game design.
Sure. And like...
Also, L&C has 18 cards with writing. Like, that immediately is inelegant.
I think of this as, and by the way, you know, you guys can all disagree with me. I don't care. It's my list. You make your own podcast. But for me, I think what it does with 18 cards is so special. There's so many layers to it. Every turn that you play a card, you're kind of doing similarly to what Pierre was describing in Schottentotten. Poker was one of John Perry's inspirations for the game. And every turn that you play a card, you're functionally raising the pot, because every turn you stay in, the stakes of the game increase. It's like automatically snapping in Marvel Snap if you played that. And I think the elegance of just every time you play a card, raising the stakes automatically, I think that's very elegant. I think that's a very clean design. 18 cards, each of those cards has so many different types of interactions with each other that might not be immediately apparent. They're, like, every time I teach the game, people play it for hours and hours, and then they're like, oh, wait, we should do something else, you know? Like,
and just to be clear, I love it, Air, Land & Sea. Love it. I think it's great. It's on my shelf.
For sure. But yeah, Air, Land & Sea, I think everyone should play it to learn how to make elegant games that are very deep.
All right, this is one that is very dear to both of our hearts. Fully utilized component hooks. I've got three very different examples here.
Fully utilized component hooks.
I can give you the opposite of the example, which is probably Everdell, where it has like this huge component hook that is completely irrelevant to the game and you can get rid of. No flame on Everdell, I love it, but it is not a utilized component hook.
I don't know.
So what I specifically mean is you couldn't play the game without it, or the game would be significantly worse without it. It's a component hook not just to sell the game, but because it actually makes the game better. So I'll give you my third example first. Not that it matters, you can't see the list. Because this is like the epitome of that. The Fuzzies by CMYK.
Ah, yes. I picked that up. I haven't played it yet.
You know the premise there?
Yep. Go ahead, tell me. I don't know what it is. Please tell me in the audience.
It is Jenga, but instead of with planks of wood, you've got little fluff balls. So every turn you're picking one up from lower in the tower, putting it up higher, and trying not to make the whole thing collapse. You literally couldn't make this game without that component, and the component is the hook. Like, that is as much as you can fully utilize a component hook.
Yep, that's a good one.
Wavelength, also from CMYK, I think this is something they do spectacularly well. Wavelength has this really cool plastic screen thing that you move around, and you could play without that. It would be less fun. Like, it is not like the tree in Everdell where it's just sitting at the side and it's like, oh yeah, cool, that's the thing that exists and blocks the board for half the players. This is like, you're using it every turn and it's making the game better and you get to spin it and it's all clicky-clacky and it just like, they don't just put this in so you buy the game, they put this in because it makes the game experience much better.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that necessarily hits the, like, you can't play it without it sort of level, but I think it's as close to that as you can get without it. Like, it makes the game so much more fun to do the slow reveal on that.
Yeah. And well, even the way it randomizes, like, how would you do that game otherwise?
Yeah.
You'd have to be designing a different game. Mm-hmm. And then the last one is the one that I thought you might guess, which is Zulkin.
Oh, that's clever. Yep. That's a good one.
Those interlocking gears are the reason people want to play, and then the reason the game is fun. Like, everything is built around those gears. You could not take them out without it being really tedious. And it is, actually, I think it's a masterpiece.
Technically not true. Arborea does that same thing, but without the gears, it has little slidey cardboard pieces. Now, absolutely not as cool as Zulkin. Probably less usable than Zulkin, so I think it's still very reasonable to put on your list.
What does it do? I'm not understanding. I haven't played Arborea.
Yep, no worries. So, from my understanding, Zulkin, you put a worker on the thing. The longer they're on the thing, the further you move and the better the thing you get on the end. This does the exact same thing, except you're on a straight track. If you can look at a screenshot, it's...
Yeah, I've got it up.
So you put them onto that cardboard rectangle, and then it slides up one. It slides up one each turn. If someone else hops onto it, then they can slide it up more. And then once it moves, you can hop off, and the longer you stay on, the more things you get.
Are they independent? Like, if one slides up further, do the others?
Oh, no. Each one is completely independent. Is that different from Zulkin?
Right. In Zulkin, they are interlocking gears. Ah. Every time, at the end of every turn, you move a gear, it moves every piece on the board one.
Yeah, okay, that's definitely...
And there is a special action that once a game you can move it twice, and that could wreck everyone's plans all at once.
Gotcha. Yeah, these ones are independent. That, players have a little bit more...
So I was like, how can that be done without the gears? Like, I guess technically you could sit there and, like, move a bunch of stuff, but, like,
yeah, no.
Why would you?
Yeah, no, you're right, for sure.
All right, gotcha. So yes, fully utilized component hooks.
I'm going to tell you the... best product design I have ever seen. So this one, you don't actually need to play. Okay. You can just take a look at nicely. Do you know what this one is?
I would guess Flamecraft.
Nope. Canva.
Oh, yes. Canva's up there, yeah. Canva, especially from a physicality point of view, whereas I think Flamecraft...
Canvas.
Yeah, I haven't played Canvas, but I actually almost played it yesterday. I think Flamecraft would rival it. Canvas obviously has the, like, hanging stuff up and transparent cards, but I think Flamecraft completely slaughters in terms of just pure theme.
That tells me you haven't taken a good look at it in person, because the box of Canva is a game of painting, right? So you have.
Do you mean Canvas?
As I said, I'm not going to sound like an idiot. Canvas with an S, because that's how you say canvas. Canvas is not only a game about paintings where you have plastic card crafting transparencies and you get to, like, see the paintings as you build them. It itself, the box, is a painting. They don't have the title on it or anything. It just looks like
work. You just hang it on the wall.
And it's got, a hole on it. You can just hang it. I think
that's really cool. I think it's amazing. I think Flamecraft has more appeal to more people than that game does. I think that the premise of Flamecraft, of the little artisan dragons, and then the sheer level of production of every component and the art, like, I think it all comes together to rival Canvas. I think they're, like, neck and neck.
Well, if I'm talking about just sheer component quality, then I'll give it to Mechs versus Minions. But for me, Canvas as a product, everything comes together in such a perfect way that everything just makes so much sense. It's not like Flamecraft is itself a dragon, right? But this one, you literally hang it on the wall like a piece of art. You pull it off to play, and then you make pieces of art as you play. To me, that's just like delivering on the product concept.
You like the cohesive, like, fractal nature.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay, my next one is something you actually had, but I said incredibly simple rule sets, which is different from elegance, but I put it in roughly the same category. I had three. One was Go, that I mentioned earlier, just because that game has three rules and then you can play it for a lifetime, and computers are only now starting to beat humans after 20, 30 years after Deep Blue beat whoever it was in the 90s. So Go, we all know, Go is widely recognized. A game you introduced me to.
A game I introduced you to. I don't like deep games. I don't like deep games.
Yes, you do.
Rule sets. That doesn't sound like me. Oh, wait, that's all I like. You hated
Red Sun. We played it with my son. the fact that we could play it with my son. Blockus.
Nice.
Blockus has what, one rule?
Yeah, you play a piece touching the corners, play all your pieces. Two sentences.
Yeah. Or you're out when you can't play a piece, more accurately. I have one that I think is actually very similar to Blockus, I think it was pretty definitely inspired by, that you've probably never heard of, actually. Crocodiles and Hippos?
No. Is that another Australian thing?
So, no. It's I think it's a British game. Anyway, it comes with a little canvas thing that you unroll, and that's where you can place pieces. One player has hippos, which are just polyominoes that are shaped like five in a row with two legs. Oh, sorry, that's crocodiles. And then the other one has a different shape. On your turn, you put a piece down. If you can't, you lose. That's it. That's the entire game. I have one shape piece. You have a different shape piece. On your turn, you put it down or you lose. You cannot get simpler than that as a game while still providing like an interesting, challenging experience.
Seems like a good pick.
And so I put that as even simpler than Blockus, because Blockus has like, the more you play, the more you're like, oh, this piece is useful here, this piece is useful here. You don't get any of that in Crocodiles and Hippos.
That's a good one. I have Cash and Guns, but not for its component. Can you guess why I have it on here?
Cash and Guns, for the descriptive title.
I have it on here because I think it does a really good job of generating energy around the table. It is very hard to play Cash and Guns without becoming enthusiastic very quickly. Even if you take people who are like normally pretty chill, pretty mild mannered, you hand them a pistol and you're like, aim it at someone. You know, someone's like holding it sideways, being like, yeah, I'm a gangster. If you have the expansion, you're like, whoa, there's other kinds of guns. I've got a deagle in here. And then you're like, well, why are four people aiming at me? What's going on over here? I think it...
No, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah, it immediately gets excited. You invested.
Yeah. And in a way, I don't think a lot of other games can compare to like just how quickly it gets people in the right frame of mind.
Happy Salmon.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one.
Yeah. Okay, this one is very... I read this list a while back, so I'm trying to understand what I even mean here. Incentivizes shifting player behavior.
That's a little vague.
Yeah, I'm going to read my three examples. I'm not quite sure what I was going for. Add Kingdom Builder, Circle the Wagons, and Cartographers.
And what do you mean?
Oh, I know what it is. Yes, okay. That's a terrible description of it. So what I mean is the rules of the game are always the same, but the incentives shift how you play the game quite a lot. So in all three of those games, the core rules never change. The difference is... In this game, I'll use Kingdom Builder as an example, you care about number of different rows that you reach. In this game, you care about how many different desert tiles you occupy, whatever it is. Like, there's just a different rule that makes you re-examine the way you are physically playing the game.
Yeah, this one I'm kind of mixed on as like a designer, because I feel like so many games... I should say, I haven't played Kingdom Builder. I've only played Circle of the Wagons once, and I haven't played Cartographers. So take that into account with what I would say, but maybe I just need to play those ones as my homework. But I find oftentimes it's like, when I'm playing games, they'll say, you know, wheat is worth 1 point this game. Oh, now chalk is worth... I think the one game I've played that has done a decent job of it is the Isle of Skye, because in Isle of Skye, it's not just...
I haven't played that one.
Classic. It's not just this thing is worth points, this thing you don't care about this time, because to me, that doesn't really change anything. It has things like you care about how big your lakes are, or you care about how many lakes you are, and that subtle difference...
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, okay, cool.
That's what all these games do. That's precisely what it is.
Yeah. Awesome. Then I add...
Yeah. I this is one of the things for me. Like, I kind of went through and I was like, these are the things that I love as a designer, and these are the games that I think exemplify them. Mm-hmm. My last one... I think I was getting desperate at this point. I see, it's two different categories. I thought it was one hyper-specific category. Okay, this one, I'll give you the stronger of the two categories, which is it feels thematic. The thing you are physically doing feels like what you are doing in the game.
The thing you're physically doing feels thematic to what you're doing in the game.
So I'll give you a counterexample. Cash and Guns, great example. Oh, Yogi's another, like, you're tying yourself in weird knots. It's a very physical game. A counterexample would be, like, you know, brilliant game, Dominion. At no point do I, you know, I'm putting a card down. How am I doing any of the things that that card says? This game that I've got here meshes what you are thematically doing and what you are actually doing in that moment in real life. I think I've played this with you.
Hit me.
Captain Sonar.
Ah, great pick. Great pick.
Like, I don't know any other game that does it even close to as well. Like, Yogi, sure, but, like, Captain Sonar, you are, like, exactly doing the thing you are thematically doing. For I also had it...
For people who
want
to know, do you want to run through the rules? Or do you want me to? All right. For people who aren't familiar, in Captain Sonar, there's four different roles, and there's two teams. So it's one team that's in a submarine versus one other team that's in a submarine. You're playing in real time. It's basically real-time battleship, in a way, where one person is doing the navigation, they're drawing on the board, and one person... So that feels like you're sort of charting a course, right? You're trying to avoid obstacles. You're trying to get away from enemies so that they won't be in range of their torpedoes. You have another one where they're listening to what the other team is doing. That's all they're doing, is they're listening to what the other team is doing and being like, oh, shoot, these guys are over here. We need to get out of here quick, quick, quick. And then the captain, who's just trying to keep everyone under control, and the engineer, who's crossing off parts, trying to make sure that they can keep moving.
And then the other category I had for that is similar to the Qatar Monopoly thing I was talking about, where it, like, takes a known kind of premise and updates it for a modern audience. Qatar's not a direct adaptation of Monopoly, but nor is Captain Sonar a direct adaptation of Battleship. But when you describe it to someone as, like, it's Battleship, but, like, team versus team in a submarine, and they're like, oh, yeah, I get that. Like, I know what that is, and I want to play that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really admirable. That is my list. What have you got left on yours?
Glory to Rome. Why do you think Glory to Rome's on my list?
Hardest to get.
Yeah, so for those who aren't familiar, good luck getting a copy of this game. I'm so sorry. You can play it on TTS, maybe, or something like that, or print off your own copy. But Glory to Rome...
Matina is kind of an updated version of the game. It's very similar in a lot of ways.
If you ask anyone who plays Glory to Rome, they'll be like, oh, it's completely different. If you ask anyone who hasn't played Glory to Rome but has just, like, looked at the rules, they'll be like, yeah, it's basically exactly the same.
I've played both, and I would call them very similar.
I would not. But, like, there are a lot of similarities in terms of, like, the rules and the structure, but in terms of how they play, they feel completely different to me. I have Glory to Rome on here as my example of how to do no rails on a game.
Interesting.
A lot of games have rails where it's, like, safety measures. You can only do this thing once per turn, you know, those types of things. If you play Res Arcana, that's a game where it's, like, very structured, very ordered, very pragmatic, very practical.
Yeah.
You have a lot of restrictions on how you can do anything. And Glory to Rome's like, what if you just didn't? So I think Glory to Rome is a really interesting one where you could literally end the game on turn two. You could, you know, have an ability that lets you draw 20 cards per turn from the deck. You could have the ability to play three cards anytime anyone else does anything. It's crazy. And every game of it, you do something that's insane. And the first person to break the game wins, basically.
I haven't played it, but I've heard that the train game from Bezier, Whistle Stop. I've heard Whistle Stop is similarly just, like, off the rails once you get it going.
Hey!
Ah! Anything else on your list?
I do. I have Blockus as well as Indigo in the same category, but not for what you said, which... it's a very valid thing to have them on here for. And not even for tiling, but for co-opetition. I think that they both, in a very interesting way, have different dynamics where we are playing a purely competitive game. I do want to beat every single person at the table. But there are instances where it makes sense to work together with another person in small little ways for short periods of time. And I think that's a very interesting dynamic that they both do very elegantly.
I would put Twilight Imperium on this list, obviously not for doing it very elegantly in a small way, but that is such a core part of that game. Like, it is a core part of the experience and contributes to the arc that we were talking about earlier.
If I didn't already have it on there, I would definitely do that. You're absolutely right. It does belong on there. So this is a bit of a contentious take. If I was to say asymmetry was the category, what game would you personally, don't worry about me, what would you put on there?
The obvious one is Root, Fast, Netrunner.
So that's not what I put. I put down Neuroshima Hex, because while it is much less asymmetric than Root, and in many ways, no offense to Neuroshima Hex, which I love, less impressive than Root. Root is a very impressive game. I think that Neuroshima Hex has a lot of... For the foundational games list, I think it teaches a lot of lessons that are very important to asymmetric games. I think the way that it handles different interaction points is very important. I think the way that it handles pretty extreme asymmetry within the bounds of what it establishes as the core rules very well. And whenever I play asymmetric games that aren't Hiroshima Hex, I can't help but feel that they should have taken more lessons from it, which our assigned game, as we mentioned earlier, does.
I think Hiroshima Hex is a better example than I'm about to give, but the game that taught me this was Rising Sun. Because Rising Sun, you get a, I can't remember what it is, a clan or a family or something like that, and they just have one extraordinarily simple rule that makes them play the game differently to everyone else. So it's a map-based game and you're moving from place to place. One faction, you can just move anywhere. There are no restrictions to your movement. And the way that it does that in a single sentence while transforming the game, and presumably in a balanced way, I haven't played enough to like comment on that specifically, and then like everyone has that. Since then, I've put that in so many games that I literally last night I was up until 4 a.m. working on a game, and I was coming up with characters for it, they're called protagonists. It's a game that may or may not exist, and one of them was just like, you have a second protagonist, done. Like that's it, that's the entire rule, and it just will change everything about the way that you play the game without having weird edge cases or like sort of like the rails thing you were describing. Like if a game did this and it was like, you have two protagonists but you can't move into the same place, and when you move you have to alt, like if you add a bunch of rules, and that loses what I think Rising Sun does really well, which is super, super elegant asymmetry.
I think that's a good one. Yep. I've got two more. One of them is Sakura Arms for two things. One is coupling. Every action you take in Sakura Arms has a secondary effect. If you advance closer towards your opponent, you move the token that represents the distance to your defense pool and add to your defense. If you want to run away, you're lowering your defense, you have to take one from your defense pool, add to the distance. And every single component is like that. You're using the same components for the distance, your life, your mana, your defense, which is also used for enchantments.
I love that.
Even when they're in the discard pile, effectively, they still have uses there. It's wild.
This one's a problem for me because I have a friend of the podcast, Jeff Fraser, had to sit me down one day and be like, Peter, you've coupled too many things. Like, if you just take this card and make it a different component to this card, and I did, and the game just immediately got so much cleaner and better. So, like, obviously I value that. Caverna Cave vs. Cave I'll talk about forever, but, like, I have to stop myself from doing that. And now, actually, I have some local designers who I sometimes work with, and I have to be like, you're overcoupling. Like, it's so alluring as a designer to have everything tied to everything. And while when it works, it's amazing, I feel like it's an easy trap to fall into, especially for me.
Yes, it is something that's very dangerous because anytime you couple two things together, it increases the cognitive load. And if multiple things are coupled together on top of each other, then it's exponential what it does to the amount of burden.
And it makes, also just as a designer, it makes stuff way harder to balance.
That's true. Anytime you want to change anything in the game system, you have to restart everything, right?
Yeah, I'm running into that right now with the design.
So, I saved the best for last, and by the best for last, I mean the worst for last, because this is such a personal thing for me. Peter, I'm going to send you a message right now.
AJ! Jiminy Cricket, wow!
Let me know when you see it.
Yep.
Okay.
I don't know what this is.
This is a real rondelle.
Oh, right.
When I first started getting into board games, I played a game called Perdition's Mouse Abyssal Rift. I cannot say...
Why do designers hate their audiences?
I don't know. So, apart from having an atrocious name, and it was many years ago that I played this, it would have been actually literally 8 years ago since I played this game. So one of the first games I played when I started getting like really serious into gaming and started designing, this is the first rondel I ever played with. And it has ruined rondels for me because it does so many interesting things with the rondel that every time I play a game that has a rondel, I'm just disappointed because it's not using them in the same interesting ways that they do here. Not to trash talk every game with a rondel, like, but never capture my imagination like this first one did. So there's different sections of this that are different sizes, and in those different sections, there's like a primary action that you get and then a secondary bonus that you get. The secondary bonus is tied to the exact position in there. The primary thing you get no matter where you land on there. But also it's a fully cooperative game, so each other person is going onto those spaces, and you cannot land on the space that somebody else goes to. You skip over those automatically. So you move one to two spaces, but you skip over any space that your co-op partner is. imagine what that does to a rondelle. You're like, oh, I'll go here. No, you can't go there. I need that spot. Okay, I'll try and find somewhere else to go. Or you can position yourself so that other people can leapfrog off you. It's so interesting. So I think if you have interest in rondelles specifically, you should check out this game, or at least check out the rondelle.
Is it Shipyard that has the rondelle inside the rondelle inside the rondelle?
Yeah, I haven't played that one, but I've played a bunch of the Matt Gertz games.
That was our list of foundational games. I think we came to a pretty good definition by the end of that.
Yeah, we got there.
Early on, and then gave our list. So I have some on my homework list now. I wrote up my list, so I'll send that to you, AJ, and that can be in the show notes. And I might even make a little graphic, and you can like check how many you've done, how many you've played, and how many are missing. It'll be the fun problems meme. It goes mega viral, man, in our Discord.
Sounds good.
Speaking of which, come join our Discord. Even when we're not making episodes, we are in there chatting about game design, sharing cool stuff. It's good times with fun people. I'm there. AJ's there. What more do you need?
Peter, would you like to have some fun?
It's been 2 years since I had fun, AJ. I've been dying for it. Not since you sent me that photo have I had this fun.
How about we do something that's happened between now and the last time I was going to have heard an episode? Peter, your fun question is, what is the most fun thing you've done since the last time we recorded an episode that you can share publicly?
My answer is very... I can share publicly. I went to Disney World with my son, and it was all that I hoped it would be and more.
That's very...
I can go into much more detail, but it'll just be talking about going to Disney World with my son, and I don't know how interesting that'll be to the average listener. I have a six-year-old son called Henry. AJ's hung out with him extensively. He's amazing, and he loves me, and I don't get to see him much because we live in different countries. So we had a full like 5-day vacation in which we just got to be in each other's presence on the happiest place, the most magical place on earth. So it was just beautiful. And then also my best friend and her family were there, and another of my best friends, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful time. Very expensive, absolutely worth it.
Yeah, I've heard that's how Disneyland works.
And my girlfriend was there. Yeah, so many people were there. I feel bad for missing people out. Like it wasn't just me and my son. It was like a group of 11 of us. Like 11 of the people I love most in the world all got together and hung out at Disney World for 3 days. So it was 5 days. It was wonderful.
That's great.
Alex Cutler of the deleted episode taught Henry how to play chess on a giant chess set.
Is that like the people were the pieces type of size?
If you're Henry's size, yes.
For the record, Henry is 9 feet tall, so it's actually quite impressive.
Yeah, it's crazy. He's going to die very soon. If you've read Ender's Shadow, it's that kind of situation. AJ, what's the most fun thing you've done since we last had a problem?
Hung out with you. Remember when we hung out? When you came here with Henry?
Nope. That wasn't me. I wasn't there.
Oh, well, whoever it was, they were great.
I was at Disney. That was a very fun time.
Yeah. I moved. The previous episode we recorded a year ago, I mentioned that I moved. And in that time, I haven't seen as many people. I still go out and hang out with people, but it's a much further drive for me to go see my old friends. So it was just really awesome getting to hang out with you, especially because it had been quite a while since I hung with you last. And then like also for like a full week and stuff. So playing mini golf with you and Henry.
That was really fun.
Board games. Yeah, it was great. It's a good time.
Yeah. Henry played so many board games that like, what's the time track one that we played with Melody?
Thebes. Yeah.
Yeah. Henry played Thebes, which... I mean, I had to like tweak two very slight things. I think this is one of the advantages of playing games with a game designer. They can just like tweak things on the fly without anything breaking. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Henry played Blockus. He played Thebes. He played and won Fabled Fruit. We played so many games. It was genuinely such a wonderful time.
Yeah, Thebes was also my shortlist for games to mention on this, but I just feel like time track is such a specific
track?
Thing.
Yeah.
I mean,
you were talking about the rondelle, I almost brought up like, it's weird that Thebes and the time track didn't make it on your list.
I barely brought up Abyssal Rift, whatever it was called. But
yeah.
I think for that one, it matters a little bit more because A, it's a game that no one's ever heard of, and B, I haven't mentioned on the podcast before where I have mentioned Thebes. So even though it is super specific...
Because we talk about rondelles so much, I was looking up rondelles the other day, and I don't think, other than Shipyard, I've actually played a proper rondelle game.
Really?
Yeah. Well, anyway, that is all from us. How do we end these podcasts? I feel like we end this podcast by me asking how do we end this podcast every single episode.
That is how we end every single one. So we used to end it with a teaser. We don't do that anymore because we can't be trusted. We don't want you to wait for our episode for a year.
Thanks so much for listening. Tell your friends. Come join our Discord, and then the clip will play. Bye!
Bye!
Thanks for joining us. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter at Fun Problems Pod, or reach us via email at funproblemspodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you, and if you enjoyed the podcast, please tell a friend.